I've been known David all that long, but it doesn't take that long to find out that David likes basically winning games and being the best at things. So I think I can safely start this by saying that I think I'm the person here who's known David the least long. actually, I've known him a little bit longer than he realizes, but I won't go into that. But I did have the fortune of getting to know him a little bit better during the ITP program that went on last year. And I have to say, it really was great, David's involvement in the program. And not just from, you know, bossing around the organizers, but also just really in the physics. And that really was what it was all about. So I think that was great. And I'll just mention one more thing, which is that at the recent ITP board meeting, the question of your renewal came up. And it was actually a bit embarrassing because it was a bit like there was so much praise. It was like a revival meeting. So we won't go into that. Okay, so happy birthday. Okay, so what I'd like to talk about today is implementing localized gravity in string theory. And this is, so it's going to involve two different things that I'm going to be talking about. One is in the context not of string theory, of what will be called locally localized gravity. And we'll see what that is, and that's work done with Andreas Karsch, and that's already out. And the work about string theory is work in progress with Andreas Karsch, and we've been also talking with Andy Strominger about this. So just by way of introduction, string theory certainly has more dimensions than we want, and the question is what's become of them. And the conventional wisdom, which has the property that it works at some level, is that we have compactification, which is that they all get rolled up, and we used to think so small that we don't see them, but in any case, we really do live in a four-dimensional world. All the other dimensions are a finite size. But of course, this isn't a perfect picture. How do we determine the size and the shape of these extra dimensions and their shape when they're rolled up? And the other point, which sounds a bit bizarre, but I think it's something to really pay attention to, it's actually a stronger assumption than is actually necessary for what we see. After all, we see at best our universe. We don't see beyond the horizon. And it could well be that what we're seeing is a manifestation of four-dimensional world in actually a higher dimensional world, and it just happens to look four-dimensional where we are. And that, hopefully that will become clearer as the talk goes on what I mean. And I think given that we know so little about the fate of these extra dimensions that we really should pay attention to these other possibilities should they exist. And I'll try to convince you they do. So of course this will all be based on the idea of localizing gravity. So there we argued that there was no compactification, there was an infinite extra dimension, and that a gravitating brain can localize gravity. Sundram and I had a particular example of this phenomenon in ADS5, and we showed that the compactification radius, the role of the compactification radius in that case, could be played by the anti de Sitter curvature length, L. So it's in some sense, this theory seemed four-dimensional, although in some sense it's five-dimensional. Of course, there is a dual picture. But there are other features of it that I'm going to argue aren't really necessary, but we thought they were necessary when we first wrote this down this example. In particular, there was some sense in which there was a finite volume. If the warp factor is A, we had this condition that you had integral of e to the 2a dr was finite, and that seemed to be what led to a finite value of M Planck, a real four-dimensional theory. It also seemed essential that the space ends on a horizon, which would mean there was a rigid requirement on the asymptotic behavior of the space far away from the brain. And finally, of course, there's a weakly coupled five-dimensional description, but there is an alternative description that's purely four-dimensional. That, of course, would be true no matter what if holography is true. So for all these reasons, I think this idea of locally localized gravity was important because I think it gave some insights into what's really going on. In particular, localization is a local phenomenon. In the sense that we shouldn't actually, it seems bizarre. Why should we have a requirement on the asymptotic form of the warp factor? Physics is, after all, local, so we shouldn't have to know what's going on off in infinity. So this finite volume requirement, which is integrating over all of space, is peculiar, and it actually isn't required. And what I'm going to claim is that for localized gravity, it's sufficient to have what Amanda has dubbed a peaky bit, that we have a warp factor which has a shape that would localize gravity. And then asymptotically, basically, it can do whatever we want. So what's going to happen is that there's going to be some distance scale, which holographically will correspond to some distance scale in the fifth dimension. And so there'll be some region, some length scales, over which gravity will look four-dimensional. And if you go beyond that, it will actually look higher dimensional. So you don't simply have a four-dimensional effective field theory for this. So only over a finite region of space will you imagine that the theory is four-dimensional, and it's truly a higher-dimensional theory. So there's all sorts of implications, which I'm not going to go into yet. And I'll also argue that it's probably a more fertile ground for doing a supersymmetric or a string theory realization. After all, we have much less stringent criteria on the asymptotics of the space. So before going into the string realization, we'll have to understand first the mechanism for locally localized gravity. And rather than discuss that in general, which we haven't done, what we have done is a specific example, which is an anti-de Sitter 4 brain and anti-de Sitter 5. And the setup will be basically the same as the setup that we had originally with Sundrum. But we're going to see that the fact that it's an anti-de Sitter brain will actually make a difference in the sense that it will have all the properties that I'd like to show you, which are that the warp factor diverges at large R. There's no sense in which it's a finite volume space. It's an infinite volume space. It actually includes half of the anti-de Sitter 5 boundary, and the zero mode is not normalizable. So from all these perspectives, it's not something you would have expected to find gravity localization. It's not a place you would have expected to find it. We thought all these features were necessary. But as I'm going to argue, despite all these things, we will localize gravity. So the action is just the gravity action in five dimensions. There's a cosmological constant, it's anti-de Sitter space, and there's a brain, a four-dimensional brain. And we can solve Einstein's equations. You might recall that in the case of a flat brain, the fact that it's a flat brain corresponds to zero cosmological constant. There's a tuning of the five-dimensional cosmological term versus the four-dimensional brain tension. And it was that tuning that allowed us to find the flat brain. And that's the case when you get a Minkowski brain, and here we have the log of the warp factor, so it's just decreasing on both sides. However, you have the option of not doing this fine tuning. So if the tension on the brain is greater than this critical value, you'll have a de Sitter brain, and if it's less than this critical value, you'll have an anti-de Sitter brain. The interesting thing is when you have the anti-de Sitter brain, the warp factor has both a dying exponential and a growing exponential. So when you're near the brain, so there's this parameter C, and C gets bigger and bigger as the four-dimensional cosmological constant gets smaller and smaller. So if you're in a region where you have a small four-dimensional cosmological constant, you'll find a big region where the warp factor looks pretty much like that. You only see the dying exponential. But then at some point, no matter how small your cosmological constant is, at some point the growing exponential will dominate and take over. And actually, you'll just go out to the anti-de Sitter 5 boundary rather than just to a horizon. So the claim is that even with this diverging warp factor, we still will localize gravity, but only in a finite region of space. And I don't have time to go into all the details, but basically we did the analysis a couple of different ways. One is through a propagator analysis. We can look at small distance on the brain, so small separation on the brain, and what small compared to the anti-de Sitter 4 curvature length. And you basically can expand your propagator for small lambda, and you find that you basically get the same as a flat space propagator, so you have the same potential. So as you expect, physics is local, and you see four-dimensional gravity. However, it's interesting to also understand this from a mode analysis. What's going on? After all, in the case of the Minkowski brain, we understood what was going on because we had a normalizable zero mode. And that seemed to be the key to getting four-dimensional gravity. There was this continuum of Kluge to Klein modes, but the zero mode is what basically played the role of the four-dimensional graviton. Okay. So you can do a similar mode analysis in the case of the curved space, and then you find that you'll have a suitable volcano potential to determine the modes in the anti de Sitter case. I'm not going to go into detail, but what do they look like? Well, the old volcano potential was such that it had a delta function at the origin, and then it died off to zero at large R. So the delta function supported the zero mode. The zero mode was normalizable. And in addition to that, there was a continuous gapless spectrum, which gave the corrections to Noonan's law that includes the Klein modes. Now, what happens in this case, in the anti de Sitter case, is quite interesting. What you find is that the volcano potential, oops, I didn't quite get it right, has, of course, this delta function piece in it. So there's still a delta function piece at the origin. But then it doesn't just die off to zero. It goes off to infinity at some finite value. And that finite value gets bigger and bigger as the cosmological constant gets smaller and smaller. So the key point is that the mode that's always the zero mode is the mode that follows the shape of the warp factor and is clearly not normalizable. There is this discrete spectrum which basically goes over to the continuum spectrum that we had there and has the same effect if you're in the vicinity of the brain. But the key to the fact that this works is that the delta functions does trap, delta function does trap another mode. It's a mode that we would have thought was a massive mode, and it plays the role of the four-dimensional graviton. And it basically dies off well before you get to infinity. There's some mode that's basically trapped in this region. And that's the mode that's responsible for four-dimensional gravity. So we call this the almost zero mode. And it's the key to the fact that local localization works. The delta function does support a bound state. It dominates over the Kaluza Klein modes in a finite region of space. One thing to note is that it does require that lambda 4 is less than lambda 5. Otherwise, it would be comparable in its contribution to the Kaluza Klein modes. But if you have this condition that there's a separation between the two ADS curvature scales, you do find that you have localized gravity in a local region. And I keep emphasizing that. And beyond this region, it would look like five-dimensional gravity. You would no longer be under the illusion that you lived in a four-dimensional world once you got beyond this. A technical point is that this seems weird because there's development Van Dam Zakharov discontinuity in flat space. That is to say, if you take the limit of a massless graviton as its mass goes to zero, it doesn't just go over to the massless graviton. There are these extra polarization modes. That is not true here, and there actually is no such discontinuity in anti de Sitter. And actually, for us, it's even better in the sense that we actually can work from the general coordinate invariance of the five-dimensional space and just see explicitly that these extra polarization modes are not there. So even though we thought it was a massive mode, it's not a massive mode in the sense of having those extra polarization states. So the conclusion for this part of the talk is that local localization does work. We really do get consistent four-dimensional gravity, but only in a finite region. So the result, as I said, is even without this normalizable zero mode, we do have a local graviton. There are a lot of interesting things to talk about, which I can't get into in a half-hour talk, but there obviously are some interesting phenomena going on here. It's not just a simple four-dimensional effect of field theory. It's basically a combination of different holographic theories, some which, well, in this case, there's a four-dimensional region, a five-dimensional region. It's interesting from the conformal field theory point of view, from the holography point of view. And also, just even with respect to the four-dimensional theory, it seems that there's some strange things going on because you can't get a mass term for the graviton in, if you were to write down the four-dimensional generally covariant theory, even when there's curvature around. So it seems that probably there's some small violation of unitarity in the four-dimensional theory that you would write down to try to reproduce what's going on. Of course, this is a small effect in reality, but it would be very interesting to understand better what's going on from the low-energy perspective. And there's also the possibility that you actually have some interesting texts of the holographic conjecture, something we've been talking about with Raph Bussow, because you can actually define specifically where it ends, and you can check and also with Andreas Karsh, I should say, and you can check whether you get the right value of M Planck given what you think your holographic region is. Okay. So there is, in some sense, a finite volume, but it's just of that particular region. Okay. So so that's basically a summary of the work that we had previously done, and now I'd like to show you why this more general idea of how you could localize gravity might actually permit a string realization of an anti-de Sitter 4 brain. So before I do that, I actually couldn't help but quote something that was said yesterday. So Kurt Callan actually said the importance of names yesterday. And he said something at the beginning of his talk which I think shouldn't be let pass without noting it. He described field theory as the theory of almost everything. So I think now we should go on to try to realize this in the theory of everything, which is string theory. So let's ask ourselves why it might be simpler to realize this in the context of the anti-de Sitter brain. Well, the obvious reason is just that the boundary conditions are much weaker. Gravity is only localized in a finite region, and beyond space can do anything. And a lot of the ideas in the no-go theorems relied on the asymptotic behavior, and we've lost those restrictions. Another reason, which I'll probably say a few more words about, is that the embedding of the anti-de Sitter 4 and anti-de Sitter 5 is such from the conformal field theory point of view, we're actually imposing a spatial cutoff, not an ultraviolet cutoff. And that's something we actually can get our hands on a little bit more easily, so we know what space we're talking about. So let me just tell you what the proposal is, and then we'll investigate it a little bit. So the first thing you might have is what I call the pre-proposal, is to have some intersection of three brains and five brains. Now really what we're, so let me just explain in general. We have three brains we know give you an ADS5, course S5 geometry. So when we first, when Raman and I first wrote down the our model, we thought, well, that sounds very intriguing and very close. So what you'd like to do is have some brain that you can put in this anti-de Sitter 5 space that would cut the space off and trap gravity. Now the problem is that if you really believed that you had to have a finite, that you really had to have the asymptotic conditions constrained, then you had to put in this extra brain parallel to those three brains. And it just, there just was no setup in type 2B that would do that. There was no appropriate brain. Now the key thing of what's going on here is that it's saying just start with the ADS5 course S5 geometry. Don't worry about the fact that it's asymptotically 10-dimensional because we only have to worry about what's going on in a local region. So let's just imagine the whole space is ADS5 course S5. And then it should be sufficient to, if you're looking at sufficiently large length scales compared to the sphere radius, it should be sufficient to just have, say, a three brain in that space somewhere. Because you just then have a three brain in anti-de Sitter 5, and our previous analysis should take over. Now, actually, the problem would be that if we put the three brain in orthogonally, it wouldn't be supersymmetric, and we want to have some control on what's going on. So the setup we actually have is five brains, wrapped five brains, that we put in the ADS5 course S5. So the way to get that is to have three brains setting up the geometry intersecting the five brains. And so that's what we have. And these are wrapped five brains. So these five brains sit in the near horizon region established by the three brains. Now that almost works, but it doesn't quite work, because if you did that, what you find, and I'll talk about this, is that you do get anti-de Sitter 4, but you inherit the curvature from the anti-de Sitter 5. So remember I said before that for this to work, we actually need a separation of scales between L4 and L5. So we have to do something to get that. And so what we actually have is we have a bunch of brains, q of which end on the five brains, and then you have n minus q on the other side. So you have two different ADS5s on both sides. Q is less than n, obviously, so you have two different ADS5s. But what you find then is that the five brains will be pulled in this direction, and the result will be you get a separation between LADS4 and LADS5. And you can make LADS4 as big as you want compared to LADS5 by taking Q sufficiently large. Okay. So this is really our proposal. And of course the key to the proposal is, well, this is what it is. The good things about it is nowhere is there an explicit compactification. Really, I mean, there is this S5, but really there's no compactification at all. If you look at the space far enough away, you really have a 10-dimensional space, so it's really not compactified. Therefore, you won't have to worry about geometric moduli. You might have other things to worry about, but it's just a completely different way of imagining that we descend to four dimensions. Everything's just determined by charges here. And as I said, asymptotically, the space is just 10-dimensional, or whatever the fundamental dimension is. So just to say a little bit more detail what's going on. So we have the D5 brains, which we say are in the 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 direction. The D3 brains are in the same 0, 1, 2, and orthogonal in the 6 direction. So we can write down the metric associated with the D3 brains. We are, of course, assuming n is large. We're taking basically the Maldacena limits. And basically, you want to, then let's just identify some of these coordinates so we know what's going on. Okay, so we'll take x to be x6, t, y, and z are x, the common coordinates, x0, x1, x2. And there's this other coordinate, u squared, which is the sum of the other coordinates, x3 squared plus x4 squared plus x5 squared, x7 squared plus x8 squared plus x9 squared. Okay. So the D5 brain, of course, is where x6 equals x7 equals x8 equals x9 equals 0. So then we have the, so this is basically what's defining the wrapping over the 2-cycle. We have x3 squared plus x4 squared plus x5 squared equals L squared. What about, why is it an anti-de Sitter brain? Well, if you have a condition that x goes like 1 over v or 1 over u, describing the surface, the induced metric, you can just plug in, and the induced metric is just anti-de Sitter 4. And if there is this parameter c, what you find for the what I guess I called L4 before, the four-dimensional ADS scale, L squared, L4 squared, is related to L5 squared by 1 plus C squared. So as this parameter C gets large, we find that we have a large length scale for determining the ADS4. So let's first consider the intersecting brains. Clearly in that case, from the picture, the D5 looks straight. C equals 0, and you would just find L4 equals L5. So you find ADS4, but you won't get localized gravity in this setup. Okay. So we want to get a non-zero C, and I said the key to doing that is having a large value per Q, having some of the 3 brains end on the 5 brain. And then what you find is that X6 goes like 1 over U. U is the same as R when X7 equals X8 equals X9 equals 0. Basically, this is very similar to stuff that was done in the context of Hanani-Winner when you looked at the scaling of the coupling, but here, of course, we're just looking at the shape of the 5 brain. How big is C? Well, C obviously grows with Q. So C will depend on the ratio of the tension determined by the 3 brains to the tension determined by the 5 brains. So what we're interested in is having M relatively small, Q relatively large. That's the reason we took D5 brains, just because then that way we don't get a suppression by G string if we had NS5 brains, but you could do it, you could imagine doing it also with NS5 brains by taking just a huge number of 3 brains. Okay. So the key is that large Q would imply a large curvature length for the ADS4. And then you have a setup which is suitable for localizing gravity. How much time do I have? 5 minutes. Okay. So let me just say a few more words. It's interesting also to consider the dual picture. So first of all, what do we have? We have, as I said, we have N3 brains on one side and N-Q 3 brains on the other side. So we have an SUN and SUN-Q with a common boundary. So what this is actually the dual conformal field theory living on the boundary of the Poincaré patch. So let's not look at the Poincaré patch. Let's look at the global coordinates here. And the way that brain is embedded, if I draw ADS as a cylinder, is in the way I've drawn here. So it's simpler to see what's going on if we look at a cross-section for constant time, since it's independent of global time. So let's look at a cross-section. What you have is an ADS4 brain inside the ADS5 space. And as you take this parameter Q or C bigger, what you find is that this moves out to the boundary. And if you had C equals 0, you would just find that you sliced it in half. From the point of view of what's going on in the boundary, this is the part of the space that we're including, by the way. This, and so what we're doing is cutting out half the boundary. So no matter what the ADS-4 curvature scale is, we cut out half the boundary of the space. Okay, and this is the space that we include. Okay. So what we have above, just to bring it home, is it's as if we took two of these spaces, one corresponding to an SUN with half the boundary, one corresponding to SUN minus Q, and pasted them together. And furthermore, the one other thing we're using is the fact that this is actually an ADS-4 brain, so there should be a suitable duality that applies to the ADS-4 brain, so all of the information can be encoded on the boundary region and the common intersection of the ADS-4 brain and the ADS-5 boundary. Okay. So that's, and then if you take the Poincaré patch, then this turn over to Minkowski spaces, and that you're left with the picture that we had. So the dual picture indicates that this should be on the right track. Running out of time, let me just mention that you can also do a Born Info calculation that would also convince you that you would have an anti-de-Sitter forebrain due to the Born Infeld action and the West amino action and the competition between the two. Both of these grow with Q. And you find that the solution is actually an anti-de-Sitter brain, just as we said, and that it gets flatter and flatter as Q gets larger and larger. Of course, this has all been a probe calculation. To really complete the picture, you actually have to consider the back reaction and see whether this actually does what we want. We're not completely finished. I should have said that. But I just want to mention the one danger is that there are two possibilities, basically. We have different anti-de-Sitter spaces on both sides. So we have a different, we have an SUN on one side, SUN minus Q on the other side, different curvature scales on both sides. So actually, the fact that there's a positive tension brain, which of course here is the M5 brains, means that you can satisfy a jump condition in two different ways because these two curvature scales are different. One is that you could have a positive slope going to a less positive slope. The other is you could have a positive slope going to a negative slope. And we claim this is what's going to happen in the end of the day. I can give you a few arguments why we think this is true. In the intersecting brain case, although that isn't a case that localizes gravity, it's a case you can look at the warp factor, and there is this D2 symmetry in that case, and that's the one case where you have just SUN on both sides, the D3 brains go through. So there's no choice if there is a discontinuity across these positive tension brains. And we know they're positive tension brains. That's basically the brain tension is coming from the Born-Imfeld action part, not from the other part, which is independent of the metric. But in any case, we know there's a positive tension brain there. So we know the warp factor has to jump. And if we have the same slope of the warp factor on both sides, that wouldn't jump. So it has to go from up to down. You can actually look at arguments that apply even when you don't have the same ADS on both sides. In particular, you could sandwich two of these things together. And we know that the warp factor in anti-de-Sitter 5 is a cosh. So the only way we can get something that's Z2 symmetric is to have the up-down form. And the other thing that you can do, like I said, is just plug in explicitly to see what the back reaction is. It's not the pull solution that we have there, but from the five-dimensional point of view, we should be able to see what's going on. So I think this should be clear by now, but I just want to mention, before I conclude, why we think this should work, or something like this should work for sure. And it's basically, a lot of these no-go theorems were based on the fact that if you looked at the critical point, you found that the warp factor had a particular sign of the slope. And in particular, it didn't correspond to going off to zero. But the whole point here is that actually at these critical points, it could be positive slope. It just has to have the nice features that we want inside some finite region of space. And you can't tell that just by looking at the asymptotic behavior. A minor aside is that you don't require the same ADS necessarily on both sides, so that also wasn't really considered when people were looking for realizations, supersymmetric realizations. And of course, it's an anti-de-Sitter, not a flat brain. Now, of course, ultimately, we want to get the full supergravity solution or even a truncated five-dimensional version. And I have to say, looking at what we have now, I think the really miraculous thing is probably not that there would be a realization of localized gravity in string theory, but the miraculous thing would be if it's in a region that's perturbative and we can actually find it. And we think we're on the right track here. So to conclude, I think it's fair to say that the full implications of localizing gravity are yet to be explored. I mean, local localization showed that a lot of the things that we thought were essential to localizing gravity just are not. And in particular, you can have four-dimensional region and the five-dimensional region outside it. Like I said, there's all sorts of interesting questions to understand about holography, the dual picture, the low-energy effective field theory, because it really is different than things we've considered as low-energy theories before that might describe our world. It really has all these different features. As far as the brain construction goes, I really think this has a possibility for being the string theory vacuum. And of course, this is an anti-de Sitter 4 brain, but we did that because we wanted to have control over what's going on, and it's a supersymmetric theory, so we can actually say something. Of course, to complete the story, we really want to get the full back reaction and see what's going on. I like this. There's no explicit compactification, no arbitrary assumptions on geometric moduli, and it does conform to what we see, or has the potential to conform to what we see. Actually, of course, what we see seems to be a small de Sitter, but as I said, this is supersymmetric, so presumably once supersymmetry is broken, you can find other ideas. But this general idea of having localized gravity in a local region should still apply. There's all sorts of other interesting things to talk about from the conformal field theory on a dual point of view. The reason it's a flat brain is completely different than what we would think about in four dimensions. We're getting this flat brain by having a large charge, a large number of three brains ending on a five brain. So it just seems to have all sorts of different features. And I think one can safely say this is an alternative to compactification.
In this scenario, can you keep the Newton constant in four dimension finite while parametrically finite while taking the energy gap for the coupling to the Kalerza prime mode to be parametrically small?
Can the people factor hear the question?
No.
Yeah. So the question is, can we take Newton's constant to be finite? Sure. I mean, basically, by taking the ADS cosmological constant arbitrarily close to zero, we get finite Newton's constant, because Newton's constant should be related to the normalization of this bound state. But in any case, that's what we're finding. But the gap is determined by lambda, and so it looks a lot like the continuum case. And we know in that case, what's going on is you have a barrier, and that barrier is suppressing the Kaluza-Klein modes until you get to energies of order with the brain tension scale, like the Planck scale. So basically it's suppressed by whatever scale is determined by this barrier, which is related to the brain tension.
What keeps the five brain from sliding off the five sphere?
Okay, so basically it's because it's an ADS. Okay, what keeps the five brain from sliding off the five sphere? So basically it's because you're in an anti-de Sitter space, and the mode that would do that satisfies the Bryden-Lorna-Friedman bound. So it is actually not a tachyon. There isn't a tachyon in that direction. And another way of seeing it is just that you know that there's some definite charge for this, and there's just no supersymmetric possibility of what it could decay into.
One more question for Lisa? If not, let's thank her.